Special Senate Committee on the Art Health Plan to order, please. And at this time, I would like to ask Holly Robinson to speak to what is, I hope, for each of the members, the dash six amendments to Senate Bill 540. When we last convened last Saturday, when you were good enough to come to the meeting, we had a variety of amendments in front of us, and today we now have the latest amendment, dash six. Holly, do you want to present dash six, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council, and my task this afternoon is to walk you through the dash six amendments, and which correspond to the lovely picture on the pull-down screen, which I will not be referring to because I don't know how to use PowerPoint. The dash six amendments start by revising those sections of current Oregon law that address the health services that are currently provided under the Oregon Health Plan. And as you can see from the amendments on lines 9 to 12, when actually Senate Bill 27 was initially passed, there were four generic categories of types of services that would be provided. And the intent of the Section 1 amendments and the changes to 414.705 are to basically specify or add a greater specificity to what those services are. So currently, the services that would be provided, both now and then, are those services that are required by federal law to be included in the state's medical assistance program in order to qualify for federal funds, physician services, prescription drugs, laboratory and x-ray, medical supplies, mental health services, chemical dependency services, dental services, provider services, outpatient and inpatient hospital services. The second section, subsection 2 of section 1, then goes on to say that the health services that are approved and funded under subsection 1 of this section are also subject to the prioritized list of health services required in 414.720. So basically what this does in another way is really restate current law in terms of health services, the general policy about medical services that are provided under the health plan. It specifies those services that are going to be provided and also says that those services will be provided subject to the prioritized list adopted by the Health Services Commission. The bill goes on then to address those persons who will receive services under the health plan or under the medical assistance program and the order in which they are to be provided. And the list starts on line 11 of page 2. There are seven categories within this draft, and those categories are those people who are categorically needy as defined in current Oregon law, 414.025, 2N, and O. Those two references are to those populations that by Oregon law or by federal law we are required to provide services to, and then a generic reference to those optional populations that the state may serve. Subsection 2 of Section 3 addresses children and pregnant women with incomes less than 200% of federal poverty. The third category is adults with income between 0 and 50% of federal poverty guidelines, then adults between 50 and 75% of federal poverty guidelines, then adults between 75 and 50. Subsection 6 is are individuals who are defined as medically needy, and then subsection 7 would be children and pregnant women with incomes between 200 and 200% of federal poverty. And again, the Legislative Assembly will be responsible for approving and funding services in the order, in that numeric order. Section 4 then addresses the health services that these various categories of individuals are to receive, of course subject to funds available. And the way that we have laid this out is that those individuals that are in Section 3, subsections 2, 7, and 8, which are those that are categorically needy, children and pregnant women, will receive basically the full list of services. The persons who are in subsection 6, which are the medically needy, will receive prescription drugs, chemical dependency services, mental health services, and provider services, again, subject to funds available. And that persons, that adults, will receive services 1B to 1K, which are everything on the list except for that special category that we created for federally required services. Then this section goes on to say, and that's kind of the general premise of the section, and then it goes on to say that for health services that are provided to the categorically needy as defined in subsection 1 to children and pregnant women, that there is a group of services that must be provided as a benefit package, and that that package cannot be, that those have to be funded as a clump. And those services would be A to G on the list, and then services for adults would be B to G on the list. Then it goes on to say that the department shall develop and prioritize two different sets of benefit packages that the assembly can fund. One would be dental services, and the other would be benefit packages of provider services. Subsection 6 of this section then gives the Assembly the authority to adjust the health services funded under this, under Section 1 of the bill or under 414705 by either adjusting the benefit packages in order of priority or adjusting the population of individuals in the order listed, but goes on to say that if there are insufficient resources available during a biennium, the population of eligible persons receiving services may not be reduced below the population funded to receive services on July 1st of the first year of the biennium. So basically, what the way that this is structured now, there are two floors, for lack of a better word. There is what this assembly will make a decision about which individuals will receive services during the biennium. That list of individuals cannot change, cannot be decreased. It can certainly be increased. And that if benefits are to be changed, that they have to be done by benefit package with the first, depending upon if you're coming up or down from the list, that there's a group of benefits that have to be presented as a package or as a group and cannot be broken up into subsets. Section 5, let me briefly go back to, through the rest of the bill, and then I'll be happy to answer those questions if I can. Section 5 of the bill basically repeals much of House Bill 2519 from last session. A lot of that actually had to do with the application process and is obsolete at this point anyway, because the application, the Waiver Application Steering Committee did its job, the application went in, and there's little of substance that's being repealed. There are some sections in that series regarding basically whether or not FEAB will continue to participate that stay on the books. Section 6 identifies that the provisions of this bill will become operative basically when we get approval from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services to modify the current waiver. Section 8 is the transition piece, so that if this legislative assembly is not sunny-died by July 1st, that there's a way of transitioning people from the old biennium into the new biennium. And then Section 9 is a conformance amendments. And with that, I will be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Holly. Let the record show we are in work session on Senate Bill 540. And we have before us the Dash 6 amendments, which have just been explained in detail by Holly Robinson, the legislative counsel, who is, of course, the legal counsel who put together the Dash 6 amendments. Also, for the record, the bill has a Ways and Means referral. I want that all understood. So that is, I think I've described exactly where we are in this process. So now the question is, are there any questions for Holly at this time regarding her testimony here today? Any questions?
I have a question.
Excuse me. Senator John Minnis, please.
Holly, in Section 3 of the bill, page 2, line 9, the Legislative Assembly shall approve, and it goes on to say and fund. That language, this is a technical issue, appears to bind future legislatures, even though it's not permissible to do so. And I'm wondering whether or not there might be a better way to say what it's trying to say.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis,
the 72nd Legislative Assembly approves and intends to fund the following blah, blah, blah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnich, you are correct, but the reason that I chose to go with those words, because each legislative assembly is funding its own budget, is that I wanted it to be parallel and be clear that the process was basically the same that's anticipated in Section 1 of the bill when we amend 414705. The language is identical because it talks about health services means at least so much of each of the following as are as approved and funded by the legislative assembly. So what I wanted to make it clear was that these two pieces are going together and that the flip side of one is that the legislative assembly is approving it, but every legislative assembly is going to fund to its own line, basically, and so I think that your concern is addressed in that way.
Okay, I can buy that. Second question. Subject to funds available means what?
Can you say that again?
Subject to funds available, what does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, it means that, I think in the context of this and every time that phrase appears in our statutes, that the Legislative Assembly has a has been directed by law to do certain things, and to the degree that they have been the agency has been allocated money to do it, that's what they shall do.
All right. So inherent in that is the level of funding that the legislature may approve or not approve.
Correct. Mr. Chair, 10 minutes, that's correct.
What I wanted to, get clear on the record. And then also on page 3, you mentioned something in Section 5 about FEOP and whether or not FEOP participates. Can you expound on what you're talking about there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I'd be happy to. When 2519 was passed, there was a piece of it that was also part of the waiver application that said and approved by the feds that public subsidies could be used to purchase through FEOP health insurance for for OHP standard clients, basically. In looking at which sections of 2519 to repeal, in part because this will replace that, it seemed prudent to leave the possibility, as opposed to the mandate, that FEOP do that should the Assembly want to use that as an option, and because it has been approved by the CMS. There's no directive in here that they have to do it, but it wasn't contingent on the waiver being approved, and so at this point, from a conformance standpoint, more than anything, it was left in, which is not to say it can't subsequently be repealed, but it wasn't. It's no longer of all the provisions in 2519, it's one of the few that's not obsolete anymore because the rest of it was primarily an application process.
Senator Bill Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Holly, this question came up on Saturday, and I did speak with Senator Winters about it this morning. The employed persons with disabilities, where are they in this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, they would be on line 12 on page 2. They would fall into that definition of individuals who are covered under 414.025.20 as a optional population covered by the department by rule at this point.
Good. Thank you.
Further questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Excuse me, Senator Bill Fisher, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Holly, back to the subject of funds available. Let's say funds aren't available. How is there any recommendations or any mandatory ways of scale back involved in this particular bill with the amendment that shows how it would be done or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, yes. There is the ability within this bill to scale to if the assembly. The reason I'm hesitating or stumbling is that you can look at this from two ways. You can either look at this as do we fund everything and back up, or do we fund at the beginning and add? And depending upon how you approach this, it gets kind of confusing because people look at it in both directions. The legislature has to fund a certain level of minimal services but they can also decide what population they're going to serve it to. Okay, once that decision, in the way that this bill is now drafted, so at that point, this assembly can make two decisions. The people that they're going to serve, there's a basic benefit package that has to be provided, and then there's a population of individuals that has to receive that benefit package. Once those decisions get made, that's the floor. So in the event that that can't continue, if there are no benefits, no additional benefits added on, then in a rebalancing process, those services will have to be continued, I guess is the best way to put that. Now, if this assembly funds beyond the basic benefit package, then those services can be subtracted. But there is some, there is a floor at which this assembly cannot go beyond above. I don't know exactly what words you want to talk about, but there are, from a benefits perspective, a floor. Then this assembly will have to decide who's going to get that. But once that decision gets made, that decision cannot be retracted.
Mr. Chair, then what does subject to funds available mean?
Mr. Chair,
it means that we start something out here and we can't continue it. Then there has to be adjustments made. Now, the adjustments could come kind of three ways. There could be less people served. There could be less services provided to the same amount of people. A cut in provider pay, that kind of thing. That's about the only way that it could be done. And how do you continue to say that if we fund this and we say, okay, then that ends the... According to what I hear from you, that ends the subject of available funding. Then and there, we have to find the funding somehow.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, that would be a correct assessment. If this assembly funds only the basic benefit package, then that's correct. Then that level of funding to those individuals would have to be maintained in the way that this is written through the biennium, like it is currently.
So if there were other things funded in the basic benefit package, which I guess are in these blocks, that's the only way we would have any way to reduce if that became necessary without some kind of a special session and a new law or something to that effect. Am I right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, in the way that this is drafted now, yes, that would be correct.
Further questions?
No questions.
There was a debate.
Thank you, Chair. I guess to the carrier here today. I want to make sure I understand this bill. I've just seen it for the first time today. As I read this, it appears to me that a decision has to be made on July 1st of the biennium of what population should be served. And once that decision is made, those are the populations to be served. Is that correct? For the rest of the biennium?
As the minimum number, as the floor, should there be additional revenues, additional populations could be added. That's the floor.
That's the floor you have to maintain for the rest of the biennium. And as I further read this, the legislature is given the opportunity in making that decision to follow Section 3 in making that decision.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, that's correct.
Okay. And through the biennium, however, they can adjust the package. They can adjust it through different forms of dental coverage. They can do it through prioritizing various benefit packages to include in-out hospital patient services. But they cannot, if I'm reading this correctly, decide on the other benefit packages without following the order that's listed in Section 1. Is that correct? Dental first, chemical dependency second, knocking it off in that order. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, if I understand your question correctly, I don't think so. If you look at he's been wanting me to use this, and now I've been cornered. Of course, I don't know how to turn it on. You want to turn it on? I'm too old.
Can you dim the lights?
Hitting the button. Push the button.
I can't.
I know, it's a crime, isn't it? I think it's a crime if I point this at somebody, if I'm not mistaken.
Only a police officer. Don't point it at me.
I'm going to dock you.
That's the one.
Here's the button. Mr. Chair, Representative Bates. Hello.
I'm with you.
These are the boxes that are cannot be broken up. So in the way that this is drafted, if you're, those services have to continue to be provided as a block, as do, correct me if I'm wrong here, as do these services. The additional services are the add-ons and the subtractions. That's why when we talk about a single benefit package, it's what's in this box and what's in this box.
That's right. That's section 4.3 in the bill itself. I've got you. Okay. Thank you.
And then let me just to further clarify, you can also see in here there's a 1, 2, and a 3 and a 1, 2, and 3. Within each of those, there is the ability of the department to set priorities and or to come up with three benefit packages.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
John.
Thank you, Representative. I will now recognize Senator John Minnis.
I'd like to move the adoption of the Dash 6 amendment to Senate Bill 540.
Senator John Minnis has moved the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 540. Discussion. Where is Senator Kate Brown?
She was in the audience here a minute ago.
Well, we're not waiting much longer for it.
I can hear her voice.
He's not there, Ms. Smith.
There has been a motion made. It's on the floor to adopt Senate the Dash 6 amendments. There has been no discussion. Although, is there any objections to the motion that's on the floor?
Mr. President, Mr. Chair.
Senator John Minnis.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 540 as amended to the by this committee to the Committee on Ways and Means with the direction that the program and benefit levels be adjusted by the Ways and Means Subcommittee subject to available funds. And, Mr. Chair, to my motion.
To your motion.
Mr. President, Mr. Chair, the reason that I make the motion in the form that I do is that I'm somewhat concerned with the costing out of the various programs that exist in the Dash 6 Amendment or in Senate Bill 540 as it's currently constructed. The objective here would be to allow the maximum flexibility to the Ways and Means Committee and the subcommittee particular that's going to be dealing with this so that should there be some necessary changes to the bill within the confines of the budget constraints, that be allowed to occur without obstruction.
Mr. Chair.
We're in the
symbolism to the
Senator Mara Carter, please.
I cannot support that motion at this particular moment, but I would like to have a recess to further discuss it.
Okay. This is interesting. We will recess for 15 minutes, please. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to amend my motion with the consent of the committee.
Okay. Senator John Minnis is about to amend the motion he put before the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to amend my motion to read that Senate Bill 540 as amended by this committee be referred to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation.
So moved.
Senator John Minnis has moved that the Senate Bill 540 as amended by the Dash 6 amendments be referred to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. That motion was seconded by Senator Margaret Carter. Is there discussion? All right. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye. Yeah.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator
Hammond?
Aye. Senator
Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Moorehead? Aye. Senator Courtney? Yes. Senator Wimmer? Aye. Motion has passed and is carried. Senate Bill 540 as amended has moved to Ways and Means recommendation. All right. We now go to the public hearing on House Bill 3624A. And we have some witnesses. They should be coming in here any time now. The good Representative Alan Bates and the good Representative Ben Westland, special guest. Alan, Senator Representative Bates, do you want to go before us here? I understand you're going to testify on 3624, and where is, here he comes.
Mr. Chairman,
please,
I think we all should. We want to welcome our good colleague, Representative Westland, that we're so very, very happy that you are with us today. And I know all your friends here, both that are seated behind you and those who are seated in front of you, would like to just give you the best hugs and kisses and prayers, and glad that you are with us again.
Would you please step to the witness stand, Mr. Representative?
That doesn't mean we're going to agree with you.
Yeah, and Representative Bates.
It would be nice if you were
to go up through the same with us. Wesley, do you want to go first?
Yeah, just to echo Senator Winter's remarks, and thank you very much. It is so great to see each and every one of you. I mean, this has been, you all know the procedure and everything, but it's been a pretty long couple of weeks. And I am just very blessed and very thankful to A, be part of this process to begin with, and B, to be able to be back and continue to participate in something that I know is important to all of us. All trying to do our absolute very best for something we all love, and that's the state of Oregon. Thank you. Great to be back. House bill. Ms. Chair, Ms. Committee, Ms. Chair, committee members. House Bill 3624 is the result of many, many long hours of extracurricular work put in by Representative Bates, Representative Cruz, myself, many of you on the dais here, Senator Fisher, Senator Carter, Senator Winters, Senator Morissette, many of those that are seated behind us, the Hospital Association, the Oregon Medical Association, the Department, the Oregon Dental Association, representatives from the fully capitated health plans, the pharmacist, pharma. This has been a very inclusive process that began what seems like, oh gosh, I don't know, three or four lifetimes ago. Remember the first meeting, Margaret? We were in the governor's conference room, and that just wasn't quite big enough, so we all moved upstairs. We all moved upstairs to 350, and we spent 3 or 4 weeks in there every night to 6, 8, 9 o'clock at night. I would be very remiss if I did not acknowledge our august facilitator, Barney Spate, who helped lead us through some very difficult and dicey decisions in those initial work groups. And what we tried to do in that process was develop a more efficient delivery system to better serve Oregon health plan patients. This has nothing to do with revenue. This has nothing to do with determining populations. We were solely determining a better delivery system for health plan publicly funded patients. I'm very pleased to report that after the official work group meetings concluded, we continue to work very closely with Mr. Bukovian, with Mr. Bonetto, and Holly Robinson from Legislative Council to draft the bill that you see before you. I think we've got about as close as we can get to improving a system which, let's be honest, Oregon does not receive the Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement rates that many other states do. And it is easy, and has been easy, and the Oregon Health Plan has been somewhat fair game and criticized because of the number of clients on it and some of its costs. But I would sit here before you today and say that even in its old structure, the Oregon Health Plan did more than most with much less, and was a pretty good system. Not the best, and I think we have certainly improved on it. But I want to acknowledge that prior to House Bill 3624, it wasn't doing too bad a job, and I think that is contrary to a lot of people's existing or the popular opinion. What we did in our overarching goal in the bill was to determine a more efficient delivery system to where, given the population and the monies that we had, was what could we do if all we had was X amount of dollars. I think it was $833 million.
$833.
What population could we cover? We very quickly came to the... No, it was $933 million.
And we found an error.
What populations could we cover? And we very quickly came to the realization that the only population that could be covered under the governor's balanced budget and subsequently the co-chair's budgets were the federal mandatory Medicaid minimum populations, i.e. the categoricals. And even then, we were short of covering that population with what I think most of us would all agree would be a minimal health plan benefits package, which would include pharmaceuticals, durable medical goods, alcohol and drug coverage, and mental health coverage. We are probably still, depending on how you cut the numbers, $30-40 million short in providing those benefits, which are not required, with the exception of durable medical goods, by the federal government. For me, it would be unconscionable that we did not include certainly pharmaceutical benefits as well as mental health and alcohol and drug benefits for our standard or for our categorical population or whatever populations we may be able to include back now or in the future. One of the other overarching goals of our discussions was that we tried to make the benefits package look more like a commercial package. Look more like what is available on the commercial market. So there wasn't a leakage, if you will, from those companies that are capable of putting in or covering health plan patients, so they would still be included with commercial coverage, while at the same time they weren't just refusing that coverage and going back to public health care coverage. I think at that juncture, this juncture, I think those are the principles we tried to establish. I think as Barney Spate said, we had a whole list of them. I think we violated them all equally. So we were fair in that regard. And I think before I pass this off to my cohort in crime, I failed to acknowledge that I believe the Hospital Association was very strongly involved in these discussions, as well as Senator Brown. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's certainly good to have one third of the Three Stooges back, as we got to be known running this bill out for 5 or 6 months, and all the nights at the spaghetti factory, and one in which you were there for. For the brulee, and I know you stole everybody else's there that was that evening, but. It's been a long and torturous journey for this bill. Many of you know, for the last 10 to 15 years, I've been involved in health care in the state, and specifically the Oregon Health Plan for 10 years. I have felt for the last 5 or 6 years that significant changes need to be made in the plan to make it more efficient, and this bill does those. Representative Westland has covered a lot of the ground already, and you've heard a lot from Holly Robinson already on what the bill actually does. And I don't want to go back through all that for the next hour and a half. It'll be a waste of your time and ours. But I do want to drill down on a couple of areas which I know you had some discussion on Saturday with, and which I might be able to help you with. One is pharmaceutical benefits, and the other one is the PCL situation in the Portland area, or even across the state. The basic difficulty in managing pharmaceutical benefits for this population is either you manage them or you take a substantial rebate for them. It's very difficult under federal law to do both. If you're in a managed care plan, you can get rebates of 3 to 6%, usually on the basis of the quantity of drug you're buying. And then you manage those drugs very carefully in your capitated service in such a way that you can have substantial savings, preventing overutilization, proper utilization, and moving market share if necessary to get the best drug for the best price. That's the way commercial plans work, and that's the way the fully capitated health plans work inside the Oregon Health Plan. We felt that was the best model, and that's one of the reasons, amongst others, that this plan tries to move people into fully capitated plans. The other way to purchase drugs is on the fee-for-service side. You can get substantial rebates on those drugs, about 15% or higher, up to 25% sometime on those drugs, but there's not much management allowed in that. We want to run both those programs through a benefit manager to get best prices on both sides. And then we've decided in this bill to use the fully capitated health plans to help manage those costs of the fee-for-service patients, not only for drugs, but for other parts of their health care also. The key thing to know about that is that once you are no longer fully capitated, your risk drops substantially for how those drugs are used. And you don't want to be in a situation where, while you're managing the cost of drugs and keeping them low, you're blowing up other parts of healthcare, hospitalization or provider usage. This bill speaks to that also. It states that OMAP must watch those managed care plans when they manage outside of their fully capitated plan, when they manage the fee-for-service area, to make sure that at least it's cost neutral, that you're not losing money in the overall plan. Because if you start doing that, you can see people starting to play games. We'll get the pharmaceutical costs down, and we don't care about the rest of it. You don't want that to happen. This bill doesn't speak to that. So those of you who may have had some concerns about how that bill read, you have to read the entire bill, go back, understand that there is oversight for the plans and how they're spending their money. The other issue, which is more complex, is the possibility of bringing back what's called a physician care organization. PCOs, or physician care organizations, are at-risk plans, but only for x-ray lab and the physician services, not for hospital services. Now, there are certain areas of the state, especially the Tri-County area around Portland, where it may not be possible to have a fully capitated plan. About half the population there is not in the capitated plans, and it may be difficult to get them in. Kaiser and some others want to be able to at least offer a PCO. This bill allows them to do that under very specific conditions where they don't impact any fully capitated plans because we don't want to lose any of those plans. But we are willing to go to a PCO as a step back if we can't get people signed into fully capitated plans for multiple reasons, primarily costs. I want to make sure that people understand that a PCO is not necessarily a step backwards nor a step forward. It's just a different way of managing this population. And I also like to make clear to people that while many individuals no longer like managed care, they think HMOs are a bad thing, that really isn't necessarily true. In this particular population, where they are not real sophisticated about their health care, it can be a real boon to them. You can get them into good access, get them to the proper physicians, get them to the proper treatment centers, and get them the proper drugs. They don't always make the best decisions in this group, and they need not so much managed care as guided care, and that's what these plans do. I'm not going to sit here and talk much longer because I can go on and on and on about this stuff and give you trivia you won't want. I'd rather open it up to questions. If there are any questions about the bill you have at this time that I could offer an answer to, I'd like to do so now.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Brown.
Thanks. For either one of you, Section 3 lists the exemptions. I'm curious as to what criteria you used in establishing the exemptions under the bill.
I think that's a great question, and I will answer your question, but I think it's helpful to getting a flavor, a background for your question. I want to take off on Representative Bates's description and desirability of fully capitated health plans for a minute. We are fortunate. Oregon is very fortunate. Almost in spite of ourselves, we have been able to hold on to, double-digit numbers of health plans in this state. There are 14 of them. We are one of three or four states that, have the benefit of having such multiple fully capitated health plans. And what that implies is that this care is provided by a local slash regional providers. This is very much the antithesis of what many people think of in managed care, is that to get permission for their procedure, they have to call Pittsburgh or Peoria. No, these decisions, you know, are made locally by local providers that are responsible for caring for local people. And that is one thing that I think Oregon deserves some credit for keeping this high number of fully capitated health plans, and one thing that I think changes the flavor of what many people would think of as managed care. So to answer Senator Brown's question, at first, we didn't have any exceptions process in the bill, thinking that, again, this along the line of logic that localized care would be better for localized individuals. Through the department and some work with individuals with very specific medical needs that already had access to physician and hospital services in the fee-for-service sector, we came through and established that long list of exceptions that you see, as well as what I call some flexibility language at the end there that allows people that weren't caught in any of those specific exceptions processes to gain some exceptions to being, quote, put into managed care.
To people in this Section 3, and it's an important section, do not absolutely have to be in managed care. That's the key thing here, that they can be in managed care, but it does not require them to be in managed care. There are several reasons for that. Some of these groups, by federal law, cannot be forced to managed care. The American Indian, was a member of a tribe, is a good example of that. There also are people here, we left a section here for if you're in a county or an area where your plans are full and cannot give you a managed care option at that point. You're not forced into one that is overly full and you won't get any access out of it. Also, there's individual situations, such as a woman who's in the third trimester of pregnancy. Capitation for that pregnancy, which would normally start in the second or third month, has not been there. The woman enters the program with the possibility of a significant cost to that pregnancy, or if there's a complication of the pregnancy or of the delivery of the child or the care of the child afterwards. We want to leave that in fee for service. Just a few cases like that coming into a managed care plan can substantially affect the financial future of that plan. Someone who's entered the plan early in pregnancy is a different situation. And so we wanted to keep those people in the plan, but we didn't want people coming into managed care plans at the last moment with something that might prove catastrophic financially for the plan. Patients still cared for in a fee-for-service, of course, but they're not necessarily forced into a plan or required to be in a plan. It's a may, not a shall. That probably answer your questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Section 11 talks about the department contracting with fully provide health service except antipsychotic drugs. And could you talk about that particular exception and how you came to this particular decision?
Outside of antipsychotic drugs, we have a group of drugs called 7-Elevens, and I always kind of thought that was a strange number considering it's the name of a store that says it's open for long hours, but it's apropos for this group.
It's really Chapter 7 and Chapter 11 of the
Federal Code.
Right.
Okay, but we find out all this interesting trivia as we went through this. 7-Eleven drugs are made up of antidepressant medications, certain types of tranquilizers, and certain mood-altering drugs. 70% of those drugs are written, frankly, by primary care physicians inside, in this group, a health maintenance organization, or FCHIPS, or on the fee-for-service basis for primary care. There's a clear distinction between those drugs and what also is included in those drugs, the antipsychotics. Antipsychotics are a very special group of drugs that really, for the most part, should be managed by people who have a good knowledge of them and are usually psychiatrists or people specially trained in that area. They also have very little room for substitution or movement, and they are more art sometimes than science. We felt that management antipsychotic drugs was inappropriate and they should be exempted out of any attempt to management. However, the antidepressants, some of the tranquilizers, are commonly managed by commercial plans and done so successfully with best practice guidelines and other methods. We want to bring those under the management guidelines that we see for other medication drugs also, without significantly, we felt, impacting people who have severe chronic mental illnesses. And that was the goal in that statement and that understanding. We cannot, under federal law, make a decision based on the diagnosis of the patient, so you only can go with the class of the drug. If you could have said that only certain types of mental illness can have managed drugs and others can't, that would be probably a cleaner way to do it, but you can't do that under federal law. So we felt this was the best way to approach a significant portion of drugs being written in the state, but not really impact the mental health of the seriously mentally ill and chronically mentally ill.
Obviously, as well as the cancer and the AIDS drugs, which are still continue to be carved out. But in simplest terms, what we're trying to get to is that class of pharmaceutical that is some very large percentage, 60, 70, 80%, prescribed by a primary care physician. And those are not the folks, the type of provider that's seeing the severe and chronic mentally ill patient. The last thing we're trying to do is restrict in any way access to any pharmaceutical that severe and chronically mentally ill patients may have need of.
I'd also add that if you find an individual patient, you may find that patient taking tranquilizers or antidepressant drugs who is severely psychotic. Those drugs would not be managed by definition because that patient is also taking antipsychotic drugs. Clearly, we're trying to differentiate between these two classes of patients, and this is the best way we could do it. And the physician's mind is very clear. Someone who's psychotic is very different than someone who's depressed or anxious. While there may be some depression and anxiety involved in that psychosis, when someone's psychotic, it's a whole different ballgame. It needs to be treated entirely differently, and those drugs cannot be managed for that individual. That has to be something. It's a decision by the physician or the care provider for that patient, and not something that can be managed by a health care plan.
Section 12. What was your purpose in including this in the bill?
There's a great deal of discussion in the committee, and you may have seen some of the letters that came out from our hospital provider partners. But the simplest and most direct answer is that hospitals were declining to see fully capitated health plan patients. They just would not serve them. We felt that it was imperative and part of their social contract that they should be required to see patients that are clients of fully capitated health plans. And at the same time, we struggled with this for a long time, and we finally couldn't get there. And in fact, we're working on some concepts now with Mr. Bonetto and Mr. Bakovian about how hospitals should be reimbursed. We tried to come up with they will be paid such and such, and they have to take the patient. And right now, as it stands, what happens is, and this advantages, if you will, the fully capitated health plans a little bit. They enter into negotiations. And again, this is pretty much a tri-county area problem. This doesn't happen in Lane County or Roseburg or Bend. It happens in the tri-county area where the fully capitated health plans enter into negotiations with the hospitals. They're not so incented to negotiate because if the, quote, negotiations fall apart, the fee schedule automatically goes back to a fee for service level reimbursement. So we're working trying to come up with an appropriate reimbursement rate, you know, in exchange for, and I will say this, even if we can't, I sit here, stand here in front of you saying I believe it's part of the hospital social contract to take Oregon Health Plan patients.
Mr. Chair, let me flesh that out a little bit more for you, too. The explanation was excellent. In 12 or 13 of our areas where we have fully capitated plans, there's not a great deal of a problem. If you're in a more rural area in the Portland area, you have one hospital or two hospitals in your service area, those patients are going to be seen and taken care of at that hospital, irregardless of whether or not there's any other hospitals involved, because there's not any. They have to geographically go there. By law, if you have an emergency room patient needs to be admitted, they have to be admitted to something called a COBRA violation if you don't do so. We're talking about elective admissions to the hospital here primarily. In the Tri-County area, we ran into the problem of a threat by hospitals to the care plan saying, we will not admit your patients into our hospital on an elective basis. I'm not sure that ever actually occurred. A letter was sent out during the time we were going through this stating that we will not be taking those patients. The hospital's position is on it. If you send us a patient and we don't have a plan agreement, we'll get paid for fee-for-service rates, which are about 50% of their actual costs. So the hospitals felt they were being under-reimbursed. The plans felt that they should take the patients. There also was situations in which some of the capitation rates for hospitals may have been higher than the actual fee-for-service rates, and that money is being shifted over to other parts of the payment schedule inside the plan. So there's a lot of complex give and take in the situation, but we wanted to be certain that those patients would be seen and would be admitted on a basically elective basis when they needed to be, and would not be left until it became an emergent situation and had to be forced in the hospital at that point. Having said that, we struggled with this for weeks and never came up with what we thought was best language. This is probably the part of the bill that most of us have the most concern over. My expectation is that we are going to continue to work and offer to this committee an amendment to this section, which may well rate this not on the basis of the way we've stated here, but on the basis of a benchmark to the Medicare rates, which have been accepted across the state and across the nation as a basis for the possible reimbursement for hospitalized patients, and is fairly accepted by most of the hospitals in the state. It's different for each hospital because of rates being different in each hospital, but it's something we can use as a benchmark, which might resolve this problem. We're going to work on those amendments for the next couple of days.
Senator Minnis.
Gentlemen, with respect to the prescription drug provisions, there are a number of them here, specifically Section 15, previous sections. The question I have for you is whether or not any of these provisions are intended to change Senate Bill 819 from the 2001 session, specifically with respect to prior authorization.
Let me just answer that in a screaming one-word answer. Well, I can't do it. You know, absolutely not. Okay, no.
Could I then follow up, Madam Chair?
Follow up.
Would you mind, because I'm preparing amendments that would make that specific and very clear.
Yeah.
I don't believe in reading it that it is clear. And one thing I've learned is that if you don't say it clearly and say it again, that the department will from time to time take off on a tangent.
Senator Minnis, Section 15 is probably not the section you might be concerned with. That's a good segue into it at least. Senate Bill 819 was designed to bring some form of management into the fee-for-service part of the Oregon Health Plan as far as pharmaceuticals is concerned. The impact this bill might not have on that, if it goes the way we want to, is you'll have more people in managed care and less in fee-for-service. And when you're in managed care, as we knew when we put Senate Bill 819 out, those pharmaceutical benefits will be managed on an individual plan basis, and I don't think anyone has any difficulty with that. There is nothing in this bill, I believe, on the fee-for-service side that significantly changes the effect of Senate Bill 819. It certainly wasn't the intent of us to do that. And if you have amendments which you think would make that clear, I would be happy to look at those with you and work with you on them. I understand your sensitivity on that. You were a big part of Senate Bill 819, carried on the Senate floor, and carried it well, and we appreciate that.
Madam Chair, let's say the Council Committee met the other day today and went over an existing rule that the department's adopted that legislative council believes is in direct contrast or in violation of the legislative intent Senate Bill 819. So I guess it would be my purpose to clarify that conflict in an amendment to make it eminently clear that what you've said on the record is in fact what the law says very clearly. Could I go to another question?
Yes, you may, Senator Minnis.
With respect to Section 6, we had a discussion, I believe, on Saturday that there is one organization in the state that qualifies with the parameters stated in this section. Could you help me understand what is being accomplished by this section? And it talks about accepting financial contributions and seeking federal matching funds, et cetera. Could you help me understand?
To set up, Madam Chair and Senator Minnis, to set up a PCO takes some significant change in the software you might be dealing with as far as billing procedures and management of that PCO. Kaiser Permanente has stepped forward and said that they would pay for that to be done, which is probably in the neighborhood of up to $100,000, and that would become proprietary to the state of Oregon. They would donate it to us to be used for other PCOs if they so chose. And that particular sentence, it pertains to that, that offer by Kaiser.
Okay. Again, I think it's clear, it should be clear for the record that what's being accomplished here is the development of the program that would help facilitate the PCO environment that you're intending to create. So, is that right? Or?
Madam Chair, Senator Menace, that's correct.
All right.
If I could, Madam Chair, Senator Menace, I want to be very clear, and I think this bill spells it out very carefully and establishes very high bars for creating new PCOs. The purpose of Section 6, as well as some of the permissive language that allows the establishment of PCOs in other areas of the state, but particularly as it relates to Section 6, is this applies mostly again to the metro area, where approximately half of the fee-for-service patients, clients in the state exist, where the existing fully capitated health plans do not have the capacity to take on the approximately 13,000 patients that we can at least get some not only cost savings for, but better access to those 13,000 souls in the Portland metropolitan area. That's what Section 6 is really all about. Kaiser stepped up the plate and said, hey, we'll pay for the IT marriage between their systems and OMAP, and then that technology becomes proprietary to the state of Oregon. So,
my last question for now, is it your intent that all of the deliberations and discussions that would be occurring within DHS regarding the development of these programs would be public information, open to the public, meetings laws, and that various interests would have access to deliberations?
Madam Chair and Senator Minnis, that was never a specific discussion. My sense is that the program itself and the development of the program would certainly be open. However, in developing that program, there might be certain proprietary information that Kaiser has that they really don't want to share with their competitors, and that would have to be shielded, and I think that would be a reasonable thing to be shielded from. But the development of the program itself and how that program was applied, I certainly think would be open.
Chair, I just suggest for the committee that issue, having not been addressed and not worked out, I think ought to be researched to some degree. There has been, again, a history of some meetings and some development going on within DHS that has not been clearly in line with the open meetings law. And I understand the proprietary nature of protecting information, but if the intent is to develop a computer program that would facilitate the development of PCO, I want to make sure that that portion of it and that work, in fact, is public. I don't want to find ourselves in a position where we have another state accident insurance fund that has proprietary information that the Court of Appeals disagrees is proprietary. It should have been made public, so I don't want to find ourselves in that boat.
And if I could, Chair Winters and Senator Minnis, I know I can speak for Representative Cruz as well as Representative Bates. We would be very happy to work with you or any members of the committee, Mr. Bonetto and Ms. Seeley, to come up with the appropriate language, the appropriate amendments, not only for this issue, but any issue that comes before us. We're proud of this bill. We hope you can make it better.
And frankly, Madam Chair, some of the amendments I've seen that Mr. Bonetto and Mrs. Seeley have brought forward are something I think will improve Section 12 especially. We grappled with that and just couldn't come up with a language we thought was effective, and I think what they've suggested may well work with some modifications. So I'm actually looking forward to working with them on that.
Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I noticed over in Section 13, under the pharmacy benefit manager, why are fully capitated health plans only may instead of shall use that? I think we'd want to get every possible benefit we could in amount of volume of things under that to make it as feasible as we possibly could make it.
That's permissive language, Senator Fisher. It's may versus shall. We are trying to encourage the fully capitated health plans to use a single pharmacy benefit manager, but we did not want to mandate it. There are certain stages that they're all in with their existing contracts, with their existing PBM. We didn't want to set up some contract disputes. I would think, though, that they only use three different ones, all 14. I would think that within a very short period of time, we'll be seeing at least half of them using one, and then shortly after that, I think the benefits will become apparent to the other six or seven that use the other two, and they would, of their own accord, come to a single benefit or a single pharmacy benefit manager model.
Why don't we just put it in then at the end of the contract? Or what length contracts do they have, you know?
Madam Chair, I could try to answer that. I think what one of the things that has to happen here is that the primary pharmacy benefit manager have to prove that they can get those medications to them cheaper than any other way of doing it. And leaving it this way makes it a little bit competitive. Keeps that PBM that's number one as far as being selected by the state every 2 years or whatever sequence we want to use, sort of honest in doing the job they're doing. Some plans would have an option to opt out if they didn't have the best price they wanted. They may stay with the PBM they have. Conceptually, actually, was where you were at right now first. I thought we'd just hire one, and that'd be it, get the best price in bulk purchasing and bring it on down. But the plans convinced me that leaving them a little bit of an option and making it shall, not may, was really a good way to go. Gives a chance for a little competitive bidding, makes people keep a little more honest, gets the best price. Some of these PBMs might be only buying for one small plan comparably here in Oregon, but they might be buying for four or five other states at the same time. It would bring a better price in. So it's a way of keeping things just a little more competitive by saying shall, or by saying may instead of shall.
Mr. Chair.
Sir, Senator, what's it?
Representative, do we have any assurance that the PBM that we are currently working with is giving the state of Oregon the best deal possible?
What a great question.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I did not ask him to ask that question. There is a great discussion going on in this field right now, and has been going on for almost a year. There are certain parties of Phil that First Health, which is the PBM we use, is doing a wonderful job, and that because of the type of program they run with a Medicaid program where it's a direct pass-through, that there is no way that we couldn't be getting the best prices out of them, and they may be right. There's another group, myself included, that has asked for an audit of this PBM and have had some difficulty, you might say, in getting that audit okayed and done. And there's right and wrong on both sides of this question. In the commercial market, PBMs are regularly audited, but they run a little different program in the commercial market compared to the public market. In those commercial audits, it is common to find 2 to 5% in savings, which is a substantial amount of money when we're talking about programs this large. Whether those savings exist or not in the program run by our PBM for the state for fee-for-service, we don't know for sure. I still want that audit done. And I think that the administration and OMAP is now willing to go forward with that audit under conditions which would not be in a situation that would put the state in any risk as far as substantial loss of money in running the audit, but would allow us to pick up any savings that were there. We know that audit can look back up to 13 years. We know that audit is going to look at ongoing purchasing of drugs for fee-for-service. I cannot guarantee there's significant savings there or any savings there, but I think it's prudent that we do have an audit, and we audit on a regular basis.
Thank you. Couldn't we amend the bill to put language in to say there will be a periodic audit? PBM. 13 years ago.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, I see no reason we couldn't. We actually had discussed that, and at one point we're ready to offer that amendment and took it out. It might be something we should consider now, as there is some resistance.
Senator Minnis, please. But kind of following up on the same question, this whole area of prescription medications is very complex, but it's been told to me that certain generic drugs may actually cost more than the name brand equivalents in certain circumstances, depending on how the discounts work. So is there anything in this bill that would look at the lowest cost option, notwithstanding whether the drug is a generic or a name brand?
This bill is written so that you have private commercial plans making that decision on each drug for the most part. We hope to get to 85% of the population in the near future. So the question like of the type you just asked would be answered by the fully capitated health plan. We've also asked those fully capitated health plans to oversee the distribution of the drugs to the fee-for-service model also, with oversight on them by OMAP. So when you get into those kind of nitty-gritty, rubber-hits-the-road questions, that is the job of that private health plan to take care of, just as it would in a commercial market. We wanted to make this plan look very much like the commercial market because we think that's the most efficient way of running the plan. So I'm probably not asking your specific question other than to say if we went in and started to look at every single possibility in a very complex way of buying drugs, this bill would be 30 pages long. We'd much rather put people in charge of it who we have confidence in from their past history that they can do an efficient job of managing those health care benefits and not only managing it from the point of view of cost, but what's best for the patient.
Senator Jackie Winters, please.
Thank you. Just to follow along on some questioning, you mentioned that you're hopeful that it'll be 85% of the population. And part of the discussion was if we moved more to managed care, where you're managing the patient, that we should realize some savings. And just recently there is some analysis or some discussion that perhaps that may not be as accurate as we probably thought a couple of months ago when you add the additional population who might require more or intense cost to the managed care, that it could possibly be that it isn't any cheaper from going from fee-to-service to managed care.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Winters, I asked this. I was at a meeting where that was brought up, and I later found out more information or tried to get more information. I wanted to see what they were basing that analysis on. The first question I asked them was, are you comparing fee-for-service to managed care on the basis of our present rates of payment for fee-for-service, which are extremely low and below the cost for a physician to see the patient? The answer was yes. Well, the problem there is we're rapidly losing fee-for-service to the state because nobody will see those patients when every time you see a patient, you lose $5 or $10. Those patients end up in emergency rooms. So my next question was, if you factor in the cost of emergency rooms compared to compared to managed care, where are you then? They couldn't give me a straight answer on that one. I believe that every time you move someone out of managed care into fee-for-service, you either have to pay a proper amount for that fee-for-service patient to be seen, which makes it more expensive, or they end up in the emergency room, which is even more expensive. So the basic principle of managed care for this population, I think, still stands, despite what we were told that meeting.
And if I could follow up on that, I think the calculation that's being left out of that interesting, I'll use a very polite word, interesting assertion, is when they do end up in emergency room because they can't get access to providers, to physician providers. You not only have that very expensive care then reimbursed at an extraordinarily low rate. I think the hospitals do have a very legitimate argument here. What happens to that gap? What happens to those unreimbursed costs? Those are then shifted to the private and commercial markets, driving, you know, private health insurance costs even higher. And that's part, you know, the variable that I think is left out of that equation, Senator Winters.
Is it safe to say that a large percentage of the fee-for-service are in the mental health category?
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, I will give you my information, which is anecdotal, and I don't have exact figures for you. This entire population we're dealing with is different, significantly different than commercial individuals for the most part, not completely. There's a very high percentage of mental health and chemical and alcohol dependency in this group, and that's why they're where they're at. Their mental health problems, their alcohol and chemical dependency problems drive them to income levels that drop them into these areas, and that's where they get their health care at. So the answer would basically be yes, but understanding it's the cause, not the effect.
So I want to go back to the issue that Senator Menas raised with respect to Senate Bill 819, because we carved out, as you know, mental health in 819 because of the needs of that population. And so if it remains carved out in House Bill 3624, then your managed care will still, that cost gets put over into managed care, does it not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, we tried to deal with this so that, again, I'll say what I said earlier, the antipsychotics are still carved out, that group of drugs still carved out. And what we're looking at here is trying to manage the large proportion of drugs that are sent out and prescribed by primary care physicians, minor tranquilizers and antidepressants, which are a huge part of the market, but don't really apply to the population we're concerned here that are psychotic. Somebody who has anxiety or some mild depression is not in this group because of that. What I think you're driving to, if I understand you, is those people whose mental illness prevents them from taking part in regular work usually, who cannot get private health insurance because of it, those people and their medications clearly are not to be managed. And this bill tries to get to the other part of the equation, which is that 70% of SSIs, the simple tranquilizers and minor drugs that we use so commonly in people who aren't seriously mentally ill.
And I guess also the other factor in that is the multiple use of some of the drugs, and make sure one isn't counteracting the other one. And I think that was another reason why we carved out that particular population, because of the whole issue that surrounds those populations. And sometimes you can give one drug that will counteract the other drug, and we did not want them to get caught up in the whole prior authorization issue, if you recall.
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, that actually was a very big part of the discussion in this part of the bill, and we were really trying to get to the problem that is slowly growing in medicine, that people taking multiple medications, sometimes by different practitioners, especially in the mental health field, that may actually hurt the patient. And managing with those drugs is sometimes very helpful to the physician to get information about the patient is taking from different practitioners and from different programs, because that does happen. So management of some of this is helpful, but for the most part, I would agree with you. These people need to be on very powerful drugs, very complex drugs, often four or five different drugs, to be able to manage themselves and maintain themselves in society.
Another question. Is it the intent also that when the person is enrolled in managed care that they will get assigned to a doctor as soon as possible?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and Senator Winters, yes. There are some plans that actually make up a pool of people when they get capitated, and they want those people to be in to see a physician within a reasonable length of time for routine care, for history and a physical, for instance. But if they need care immediately, they have their best chance for access is to go through managed care and immediately get assigned to a physician to be seen.
Is the a length of time for them to be enrolled, is that a part of what you think that the agency will prescribe, or do you think it should be prescribed within statute?
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, we spent hours on that decision, days on that decision, and the bill reads, I think, as best we could make that decision. We talked about 7 days, 30 days, various ways of going about it. And we felt that the permissive language we use here is probably the best language for it.
And if I could flesh that out just a little bit with some hard numbers, making the assumption under the status quo where the standard population still exists, at least in some shape or form, you know, what is the additional capacity of all of the plans statewide? And the FCHIPS worked very diligently on that and came back with additional capacity of somewhere between 80 and 110,000 additional enrollees. So someplace in that range, they have the capacity for primary care physicians, you know, to see that many more additional patients.
My concern, if I think you don't have some kind of definitive time, one of the objectives is to avoid or reduce as much as possible emergency hospital use care. And so when one has a physician, you know, they're more apt to be a little more proactive to go in to see the physician rather than to end up in emergency care. And that's why I asked this particular question, that how rapidly when one gets their enrollment card will they have a physician assigned to them, right? And it may be something that we need to think about and explore further.
You are exactly right, and what we are trying to avoid and we felt comfortable with. What section are you reading out of, Senator Winters, just to help us out?
I wasn't. It was just something.
Good question.
I'll go back.
We're not reading out of that section either, obviously.
Section 10?
One of the concerns is that a fully capitated health plan could assume, yeah, we've got capacity for that individual, and they're sitting there banking that individual, getting the capitated rate per month, and not providing the service, and at the end of the day, what happens, that individual isn't getting the medical services that they require, and they end up, same thing ends up happening, they would as if they're in fee-for-service, they end up going to the emergency room, getting the most expensive care, you know, on the face of the planet, and not having, you know, gone through the benefits of what really we're trying to do with additional patients into fully capitated health plans, and that is slow down the amount of patients going into the emergency room. So, I mean, we agree completely with that concern.
Senator Minnis.
I want to pursue this other issue, the carve-out with antipsychotics and the antidepressants. Not being I'm not a doctor, I'm not a physician, I'm a cop. You know, what I do know is that some people tend to deteriorate over time. They may be using an antidepressant, or maybe using a multiplicity of drugs, and there is, I think, a phenomenon known as a drug-induced psychotic state or psychosis, and different kinds of phenomena like that. I guess help me understand a little bit more what the rationale is here, or assume you have the carve out and the other drugs are subject to the plan. How is that going to be dealt with respect to a physician's decision to choose another drug? Or I don't know if I'm asking a very coherent question here or not.
You are. You are. I'll take your first shot at it, and I'll follow up. Go ahead.
You know, if I start taking chemo, who the hell's going to be Curly?
I don't know.
You know?
And we have to switch around. We often, three of us, try to go through the door at the same time. You know, it's just that way talking to you.
So go ahead, sir.
Okay, I'll take it first. The overreaching attempt here was to make this look like a commercial plan overall, okay? I mean, one of the complaints you used to hear about the plan, and I hope you won't hear in the future, is that, you know, the guy who lives next door to me is on the Oregon Health Plan. He gets everything with no questions asked. But I'm in a commercial plan, which I pay for myself and I go to work for every day, and I have restrictions on it. And so those restrictions are already set there for some very good reasons, not only patient care, but to hold down health care costs. So that's the first backdrop to looking at this. To get to your specific question, you're concerned, I believe, about us restricting the ability for the patient to get the drug they need, of cutting them off from the medication they really need to get themselves well and stay well. We are trying to address that. We know, as I've said before, that the vast majority of the 7-Eleven drugs are written by primary care physicians because the vast majority of those drugs are of a nature that it's safe for them to write those. The simple antidepressants, the simple tranquilizers, and they are a huge part of that market. But about 30% of that market is very complex people who have serious mental illnesses, and they're the ones, I would guess, that you spend a lot of time with as a police officer. And those are the ones you saw who are psychotic, who would stop taking their medications and became psychotic, or took too much of one medication, got on too much lithium and became psychotic.
Or mixed it with some methamphetamine.
Or mixed it with some meth, their own self-medication, as we call it, or alcohol, or a combination of both. I see those people every week, and you saw them every day out there in the beat. We don't want to impact that. That needs to be carved out. Those medications should not be restricted by any plan because those plans can't make decisions in those tough cases or even give guidelines in those tough cases. That'll have to be managed by individual physicians.
Mr. Chair, I guess in pursuing this in this general, it kind of dovetails with Senator Winter's concern about whether or not someone on this plan actually has access to a physician and within a reasonable period of time, and that the physician doesn't have a barrier that's so restrictive that it doesn't really, the physician's not able to deal with the health care of the individual effectively because of barriers that are set up.
This bill really says, Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Minnis, this bill really says that you have to have reasonable access to take on a capitated patient. You just can't sign people up and not give them service. And OMAP's going to oversee that carefully. And the federal government oversees that clearly, too.
But Mr. Chairman, I guess in argument, many of these people are not very sophisticated. I think you said so yourself. And I think that's one of the concerns that I have, is that the fact that they are not very sophisticated does not mean that they're going to fight for the right medication. And if they're treated like cattle, if you will, people just moving through a door, you know, names without faces, and they don't have access to appropriate drugs, and the physician can't make a good health care decision for them, or they don't get assigned a physician, then I think we're doing a lot of stuff in the name of saving money, but not necessarily in the name of good patient care.
Our experience with the capitated plans, which have been operating in this state for the last 6 or 7 years, is that just the opposite of that happens, that they manage these people extremely well, and that's what moved us to move them in that direction, that they are not treated like cattle. They are carefully guided through their health, especially in mental health organizations, and we've gotten some of the best results from managed care in those situations that you can't count on. The worst cases we see are those that are fee-for-service, who can't get into a physician on a regular basis, have nowhere to go on a Saturday night after hours, and end up in serious problems. Our experience has been the opposite. Your concerns, I understand, they're very real. It is possible to abuse any system, and this system could be abused by a capitated system saying, we'll just sign everybody up, take the money, and give no service. That has not been the case in the state. And OMAP has a very clear responsibility, along with the federal government, which will be watching also, that not occur.
Thank you.
What flexibility does a patient have in terms of choosing their doctor? I know in my plan I can choose a primary care physician from among a number, but it sounds like there's a pool there and people are assigned to a physician from that pool.
That is usually what happens, but every fully capitated health plan, once they receive that person as a client, you know, are offered their choice of physician off of the participating panel. they usually don't make the designation. And so then they go into the pool and they are assigned a physician. But, you know, the option certainly exists prior to them being assigned to a physician that within, you know, the universe, and you take, and this varies all over the state, Senator, but I know as a generalization, it is fair to say that most of the physicians in all of the areas outside of the Tri-County area are members of their local fully capitated health plan. Not entirely true, but pretty true. In the Portland area, that number is down. But still, even within that limited universe, they are given their choice first. Most of them, you know, I think regrettably, don't make that designation.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, I guess there's more questions. Senator Brown, then Senator Fisher. Senator Fisher, you want to go first?
No.
She says,
I haven't had a chance to ask one. I did ask one.
Senator Brown, do you want to go first?
Sure.
Well, wait, could we have Senator Fisher answer first? I mean...
That's fine. Okay.
Would you two make up your mind?
Okay. Some of the concerns that have been expressed by my caucus members, or at least by folks calling them, is that we are concerned that clients under this new system or whatever system aren't aware that their appeal rights within the managed care organization still exist. And so I guess my question is, I'm assuming that you had no intent to deny, infringe upon current patient rights, and would you have any objection to us explicitly stating that in the bill, unless you disagree with that assumption?
The bill is silent to that for the very reason that you would assume, and we would be happy to work with you on that.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown,
it's federal law,
and it's very specific federal law that there is a system for saying, I want the service you denied, I want to appeal that. And those appeals occur all the time, both in and out of the plans and OMAP. And it's very common to have hearings on these and have those plans sometimes have their decisions reversed. So there would be no loss for them. It's not a new program from that point of view. It's an expansion of a program we already have. But I understand your concerns. If you want something specific, we'd be glad to work with you on amendments to make certain that people understand this does not violate any federal law, and we'll be following those federal laws.
Senator Bill Fisher.
Thank you, sir. I want to go back to the business of the PBMs and cogitating here and having had considerable experience in multi-facility purchasing and things through my business life, I really never found that I could have one of my fringe facilities bargaining on its own when I was bargaining for the center of the best good of the whole overall thing and wind up and undercut what I could do. Consequently, I kept a pretty close thumb on that type of activity because bargaining for the bulk of the unit was far better than bargaining by some fringe small portion of it. So I would respectfully say that if the state, with all of its leverage and amounts, can't do better than somebody out in the fringe benefits or the fringe areas of our state, it's got 20,000 or 30,000 people involved. If the state can't do better with several hundred thousand, then perhaps we better be doing some impinging upon the state and maybe letting those people bargain for us rather than the other way around. But I really find it hard to see how we couldn't all benefit better by, as the contracts fall off, getting on board and doing it in a must way rather than a may.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Fisher, I think the net result will be exactly what you've talked about. I have a hard time believing that a central PBM will not offer the plans a better price than they get individually. I have a hard time believing it won't happen. And so I'd agree with that. But we did leave it as permissive at this time for the reasons we talked about. There was a lot of feeling amongst the plans. They just didn't want to be forced into a PBM. Frankly, I think part of the reason for what you just said. They don't have complete trust that the state can pick the best PBM and get the best price, and they want to have some leeway to do that. If we find, for instance, that a certain PBM is getting a better price on pharmaceuticals than the state PBM is, I think we have to sit back and say, whoa, what happened here? Let's change things. So I still kind of like the permissive language, although I think you're absolutely right. We're going to end up with one PBM because it will offer the best price because of ability to do bulk purchasing. I think you're absolutely right. I'd be willing to go the other direction with you, except that I have to have that little thing in the back of my mind that says, you know, sometimes I go to Costco to buy stuff because I get it at a better price than I do in this building, and that's the kind of thing that kind of worries me a little bit. Okay.
Well, it worries, Mr. Chair, worries me too from that standpoint, because, you know, there again, I was working for myself, and I had my fingers all over the operation, and I was watching it for every way that I could. And if I got wind of somebody that had a cheaper price in Corvallis and we were getting in Roseburg or something like that, I was diving into that right quick. And I don't see any provision made for doing that here as far as the state's concerned. You know, it's maybe we ought to go the other way around and stick everybody onto the PBMs that are available, and then the state take the best route with whoever can do the best bargaining. But somewhere or another, I think that we ought to pull together and be working on the same deal, because you start splitting up very much of a whole, and you're certainly not going to get the best deal that you can get.
Senator, I agree with you, and I think you're correct as it relates to the fully capitated health plans. But I don't think that in turn, I mean, let's just face facts. I mean, Oregon is small potatoes, and we're talking about a fairly, even if they all banded together, really a fairly limited buying pool. At this juncture, as, how shall I say it, as nervous as things are out in the world of the Oregon Health Plan, I think at this juncture it is better to take this half measure. And again, as Representative Bates has indicated, help incent them to come that way before we do a mandate at this juncture. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I think you're right. But something in my tummy just tells me a little prudence at this time with regard to forcing a single PBM on them would probably lead us to as much headache as it would lemonade.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Fisher, another issue here is that these people are going to be capitated. They're paid so much and no more for their drug costs, and we're going to calculate those very carefully. If they decide to buy from a PBM and they can't get the best price from us, it's going to come out of their pockets, not ours. And that, I think, will drive them also to the best PBM and best price. And I don't mean to be disrespectful of the state or anybody in the state, but I just have a little bit of heartburn yet in turning over this big of a program to one PBM without a lot of input from the plans, who have a great deal of experience buying through PBMs at best price. And I hear you, and you may well be right, I may be wrong, but I just feel uncomfortable forcing one single PBM at this point. I think we'll end up there, but I don't know. I'm a little nervous there, and we had a long discussion about this for weeks at a time, and your view was very strongly held by a very large number of people that we should just force the PBM to be one single entity at this time. I just feel a little uncomfortable, but I may be wrong about that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I understand what you're saying, because I've had an opportunity to see a few county and state contracts and things like that that leave me with my head spinning as to who is paying any attention to the dollars and cents when things were passed out. But then, is there any way that we can demand and ensure and insist that the state makes the best possible purchase on these things.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Fisher, in my own mind, the best way to do that is what Senator Morissette talked about earlier, regular and careful audits of the PBM to make sure we're getting best price and best service. And those audits be done by a private commercial company that does it all the time for commercial plans.
Is that the best way, or should we be getting some of these care organizations to send their CEO over and do a little guidance?
Possibly both, and that has been suggested and probably will be done.
Where's Senator Brown?
Did she fall asleep?
Well, I think that's it. Representative Bates, Westland, thank you very much for being willing to come here today and talk to us about all your great work on 3624. Representative Bates, you and Representative Cruz have been here before helping us at 540. Ben, you weren't able to be here, but now you're back. So as we work our way through this, I hope we'll see you again on this very difficult area and all, so you can help us as we work our way through it.
Well, we certainly appreciate your work on this. I meant it very sincerely. We put a lot into this bill. We are very pleased with this work product, but that's what a bicameral process is all about. And, you know, our hope is that you can take our work and make it even better yet. I mean, that's how it's supposed to work. You know, one other thing, if I may. There are a lot of people, many of whom are on this committee, as well are sitting behind us, that have put a lot of heart and soul into this. I mean, late nights. Some of these were very tense meetings. This wasn't, you know, particularly a walk in the park with people throwing rose petals at our feet. I mean, you get all the various stakeholder groups that I hope I've mentioned, but they were all there every day, every time, on time, and we all worked very hard on this. Doesn't mean we all agree, but they were there very forthrightly, you know, very honestly, trying to do the best they could, as were we. And so I just, again, want to thank not only most of the members of your committee, but all the stakeholders that worked on this thing so very, very hard.
And I'd like to add that, you know, the more eyes we get on this, the more fingerprints we get on it, the better the bill will be, and we do appreciate that. We pushed this out of committee that last week very, very, very hard and a little bit quickly. We knew that. We knew there were areas that we thought you would look at and question and improve, and you've done exactly that, and we appreciate it. I think this is truly an effort by the entire legislature, and I appreciate the effort you've put into it. I might also comment that your Senate Bill 540 is also an excellent piece of work. Shows that this, your staff and you have worked hard in a very short time to bring that forward. Appreciate that also.
Thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you for coming here today. Appreciate it. We have two other individuals who are scheduled to testify, Jim Edge and Jim Neely. Are they here? Could you come forward, please?
Get out of here.
Can we do this in 3 minutes or less?
You going to do this in 3 minutes?
We are losing some of our members, but we'll hang in there. Lost one. Please proceed, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Edge. I'm the Acting Assistant Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I just handed in some testimony that is the testimony that we presented as this bill came out of the Audit and Human Services Committee. It's a little more detailed than I need to go into during verbal testimony right now, so I'll just give you that for your reading pleasure later on. And I'll do a summary of the most critical points that we and concerns that we have about this bill. First of all, I'd just like to say that we support the goal of this bill to increase access to care for clients, to provide coordination of care and finding appropriate cost containment methods. So in that sense, we're in total agreement with the purpose of this bill. We have just a few comments and concerns about it. One of them is an additional provision that we feel is needed in the bill in Section 18. The authority to continue the operating components of the program if federal approval is delayed or not forthcoming by the bill's date is something we feel needs to be addressed. And without some kind of a contingent operating authority, the state could be subject to federal disallowances. So we feel that a little addition needs to be made there. A couple of concerns about different sections. In Section 5.2b, there's criteria which requires the states to determine that a PCO would not threaten the financial viability of a fully capitated health plan. We just have a little concern that the state may be taking on financial risk there in the event of the failure of a financial failure of a fully capitated health plan. In Section 10, there's a requirement for the department to contract with fully capitated health plans for administrative services related to certain services provided in the open card or fee-for-service system. This would require DHS to contract with the 14 different organizations, the fully capitated health plans, for some undefined administrative services. We feel it would be better if this section was a permissive type of authority rather than a requirement, since much of this is as yet undefined and we're not quite sure where this section would lead us. In Section 11, there's a requirement to contract with the fully capitated health plans for all drugs, including mental health drugs, except the antipsychotics. There's a concern on our part that this removes some flexibility related to the best solution for delivery of especially mental health services, and removes some flexibility related to possibly carving drugs out of capitation. We just had quite a bit of discussion about this whole issue of drugs and whether there would be more savings in one type of system than another. Again, we're just concerned about the requirement to contract the way that this bill is designed, and not allowing the flexibility to explore another option, which could be to carve the drugs out of the capitated health plans into the department. Section 13 and 14 are the sections that refer to the pharmacy benefit manager and requiring the DHS contract with a pharmacy benefit manager to pay pharmacies and provide similar services to FCHP, which choose to use the pharmacy benefit manager. We have a concern about this section in that it could be costly to the state. It's administratively complex, and also that it may not be approved by the federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So, again, we are concerned about this being a requirement of the bill, especially in light of the fact that it might not be federally approved and thus could place us at risk of losing federal matching funds. So with that, I will stop and answer questions or turn it over to Mr. Neely.
Mr. Neely, why don't you proceed, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Neely, Deputy Director of the Department of Human Services. And about a year and a half or 2 years ago, the Secretary of State's office did an audit of the Oregon Health Plan eligibility process and determined there was a need for some additional administrative controls. And what I've passed out is a five-page document, Statewide Processing Center Oregon Health Plan is the title of it. And this is a document that sort of steps through where there were issues in health plan branch eligibility and how we have responded to those issues. And so I'll just very quickly run through those for you to let you know where we are in that process. A number of the issues related to unreported income in terms of the applicants for the Oregon Health Plan. And Secretary of State's office was interested in making sure that we used the Employment Department's wage information database whenever we could. Now, this information is not as useful to eligibility workers as it is to auditors who are looking after the fact, because employers have up to 60 days, I believe, after the end of the quarter to report this wage information. And we're determining eligibility in a more timely manner than that. But it does give pretty good information about the employment history, and so is a pretty good guide to workers. And so we've done additional training for the workers in terms of how to use that. The Secretary of State's office suggested that in a reapplication that we actually go back to the original application and review, now that we have the online wage information, the person correctly report what that wage was. We determined that would be extraordinarily expensive to do, but as I step through a couple of these other issues, we'll talk about another way that we found to get there, I think, to get the same benefit. We do use, when we're determining eligibility, three computer information screens that we have listed here. The wage screen, the unemployment insurance screen, and child support screen. So we do have some electronic data available to us in addition to what the applicant reports to us. And in fact, one of the policy changes that we have made, I think, makes the process considerably cleaner. One of the recommendations on top of page 2, pending all cases for proof of income for the eligibility determination process, we used a process that looked at 2 months back in terms of the 2 months back that the income was available and the current month, and usually we had to estimate the end of the current month. That was an imprecise process and led to some errors, and not necessarily fraud, but just errors in estimation. Since February 1st, our new policy suggests we will use the three previous months, so there's no longer an estimation error in that process. So that problem area has gone away with the new policy. Second thing, they recommended considering analyzing and reviewing the high-risk cases. And by high-risk, they typically mean cases that have either very high income or very low income in terms of what we would anticipate. And so beginning in April of this year, we put together a program integrity team that looks at cases where we suspect that either someone is reporting income that's so low it doesn't necessarily fit with their circumstances, or other areas in which what they've reported is suspect to us. And then because the wage information is not timely at application, we wait for a couple of months, then revisit the wage information and determine whether or not something has been reported to the Employment Department that would lead us in a different direction. And by probably the end of this month, I think we'll have a pretty good idea of how successful that is and how we're doing in finding other income. There were several issues around Social Security numbers and the report of Social Security numbers, how we use them and how we collect them. Three areas in particular that we had recorded Social Security numbers for every individual required to supply them. And the primary interest with Social Security numbers, again, is the automated data match, wage match, so we make sure that we're talking about the right people when we're comparing income. And we have done training on verifying and improving the recording of Social Security numbers. Some years ago, we required Social Security numbers for everyone on the application. The federal government told us you can't do that. If someone's not applying for benefits for themselves, you can't ask for their Social Security number. We have modified our application now to say that they can voluntarily give us their Social Security number. Now, we're not finding many people who voluntarily give us their Social Security number when they're not required to. But if they do, we'll record it and we'll use it in the process to determine eligibility. And then finally, we get Social Security numbers from other methods. When somebody gives us a pay stub, it may have a Social Security number on there. We now are recording those Social Security numbers, and we use those with the automated benefit match as well. So I think we've gotten probably substantially better at making sure that every avenue for automated data match exists. On page 4, in 1996, federal legislation banned new immigrants, many new immigrants, for 5 years. Secretary of State's office indicated that our policy had not changed to be in line with that. After the audit, we verified the Secretary of State's and the federal interpretation, found that indeed we had misinterpreted and had changed our policy to enforce the 5-year ban, and have done so since. There were a couple of issues related to whether or not someone got full coverage under the Oregon Health Plan, or what we call citizenship and alienage waived emergency medical that non-citizens qualify for. We've done a couple of things in that regard. One of the things that Secretary of State's office suggested was that we look at that. They didn't find instances necessarily that non-citizens were getting Oregon Health Plan coverage when they shouldn't, but they suggested that might be an issue. We looked at that through the quality control process, looked at 163 cases, and found no instances where we had actually verified citizenship that there was an issue there. So we're not anticipating a policy change in that regard at this point. On the other hand, they also said that it was difficult for them sometimes to tell if we had gone through the process to make sure that the person was getting the right coverage level. So our case management system, the TRAC system, has been modified since to produce a template that steps workers through that so that they can better narrate the decision they've come to in terms of the coverage, and that that's the correct decision. And then finally, on page 5, there was an issue with improper premium waivers. As you recall, under the old Oregon Health Plan, if someone met a number of circumstances, such as zero income, that their premiums could be waived. And Secretary of State's office found that in some cases we were waiving premiums and either not document why we were waiving, or documenting the wrong reason, or perhaps waiving premiums in error. As of February of this year, that's no longer an issue because we don't waive premiums anymore. If an individual does not pay their premium, they are not only off the following month, but they're off for a 6-month period. So,
Jim, currently how many, because they haven't been able to pay their premiums, are off? I heard some figure that there's about 35,000. Is that accurate? Is that true?
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, I think the in May of 2003, about 14,600 plus individuals lost coverage for not paying their February and March premiums. We're estimating a little over 4,000 will lose coverage in June, and maybe 3,000 to 5,000 in July will also lose coverage. So there are individuals that do not pay premiums and lose coverage.
Thank you.
May I ask?
Sure. You a question? Sure. Go ahead.
I imagine that you check birth certificates of families that may appear to be illegal aliens to make sure that if they're born in the United States, they're citizens. And so are birth certificates part of your check in terms of who's legal and who is not legal?
Mr. Chair and Senator Moore said they were in the quality control review that we did of those 163 cases that we looked at, and there were no individuals that claimed to be citizens who were not citizens. It is not part of the routine determination. People tell us that they're citizens or not, but as we checked that, we didn't find an issue with it.
Well, thank you. Is that it? Any further? Senator Fisher, do you have questions?
Yeah.
Senator Brown, do you have questions?
No, but thank you.
No.
Do you want comments?
No.
Do you have a comment? He has no comment or question. Senator Winters, are you done?
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Yeah, I know that. Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Edge and Mr. Neely, for your patience and for your presentation. This brings us to the close of today's activities. When do we meet again, please? I should know this. And for driving on this as hard as we did at 5:40.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to assume that we'll meet on Wednesday.
Wednesday at 3 o'clock in the same room, right?
That's correct.
For further deliberations in House Bill 3624.
This is just right. It keeps us from joining us.
Yes, sir. This meeting has been adjourned. Is adjourned.
You didn't hit the
will be adjourned.
Is adjourned.